welcome to MotorPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 385 for Wednesday, the 30th of October, 2013. I'm Dave Neal over in Lincolnshire in the UK, and over there in California is Jim Race. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening in the northern part of California. You know, it's funny. I was thinking to myself earlier, I'm like, how big is California compared to the UK? And I didn't do it yet, but I think it's about the same size all told. Weird.
And then some. It's you're much bigger than us.
So to speak. We've got a pretty cool show for you guys out there, and it's good to have you back again, Dave.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yep. Dave Neal, also of paddockchatter.com. You can always check out their stuff over there. Very, very cool. But a couple of bits in here. We've got Steve Brooks. Steve, you guys might remember this, and it's been a while, but his Temples of Speed series that we've been running on the show has been very popular. And Steve is back not only by request, but by wanting to do so. In fact, Steve sent me a bunch of photos and movies that I'm going to try and get posted, some of them up, probably on the Motopod fan page on Facebook or elsewhere, maybe on YouTube as well. And then you got an interview that we're going to run with Tommy Aquino, American gentleman running in the Superstock 1000 class in BSB for Team WD-40. So I'm looking forward to that. I haven't heard that yet.
Super cool kid. Yeah, he's a real good guy. We managed to catch up with him at the end of play on the Sunday. I'd spoken to his gaffer at Cadwell Park previously and said, look, can we come down and can we talk to Tommy? And, you know, we've got Motopod. It's American based. We have UK listeners for you, and we have Tommy for the guys over stateside. So, he was really waxing lyrical about being over in the UK and looking forward to coming back again next year. And just how he ended up over here is an interesting little story. So the listeners will enjoy that one.
Yeah, and we're very slowly transplanting some of our folks over to the BSB series to participate. So
you might as well.
Maybe we'll talk a bit about that too. Well, we're going to get into it certainly with a couple of news bits that are coming up. So that should be cool. I think I was trying to remember if I've had Tommy on the show before.
I'm not 100% sure if you have.
Yeah, it would have had to have been probably at Laguna or something like that, or maybe even Sears Point a long time. I can't remember. Anyway, great to have him on. Do you want to thank? We did have a couple of donators and subscribers. A new subscriber, Brian Nisek. That's probably pretty close. I hope I got it right, Brian, because you wrote us in an awesome email introducing yourself to us. As a long, long, long time listener, all the way back to the Bob days. It was one of those overwhelming emails, Dave.
It was great. I really enjoyed reading that. It's one of those, especially as a new guy to the show, and you realize just how important the show is to a lot of the listeners. It's part of their weekly routine, and they really enjoy listening, and they take on board what we say. And as you've explained to me before, that we follow them across the country, we follow them to work and back. They're listening. We're even walking the dogs, and it was great to read the email from Brian, especially from my point of view, as I say, as a new guy. And I did a little response myself, and I know you responded also. But it gives you a little bit of props. It's nice to hear good things about the show and to be part of such a great show.
Thank you. And thank you to Brian, too, for writing in. That was super awesome. And yeah, you'll figure it out over a while. You know, we get some very positive email, which is one of the things at least that drives us forward. So thank you, Brian, not only for your email, but for becoming a new subscriber. We also got a donation from Thomas Kelly. Thomas, thank you very much. Interesting amount, by the way. It was I'm assuming it was what he had at the moment. Although sometimes people will send us amounts that are kind of, you know, a little bit different, and it amuses me. I'm easily amused.
It's whatever's left in the bank account before the paycheck comes in.
Good with us. If you'd like to donate to the show, you can do so on the motopodcast.com page, left-hand side, and we'll talk about that more at the end of the show to remind you guys again, but it's very, very helpful. It is one of the things that keeps the show moving forward, hopefully getting us to some additional races and paying the bills around here. And with that, we do have some listener feedback. If you'd like to write to us at any time, you can always do so through motopod@motopodcast.com. There's also a little form that you can fill out on the webpage, but love to hear from you at any time. And it's always fun to get feedback and give us ideas and things like that. And surprise our new hosts such as Dave and Harry.
Hello.
Funny. You want to wander into this? You want me to wander into the listener feedback? We got a couple.
I'll take the first one. That's fine.
All right.
Charlie Hatfield, he wrote into us saying that in Moto2, where there is little creativity because there are only three bikes, i.e. the Calex, the Suter, and the Speedup, there's an interesting bike that use a Hossack design, the Transformers out of France. They ran in Brno and will run at the last race in Valencia. He'd like to hear more about their project on the podcast. So certainly, Charlie, we'll certainly look into that. We're all about funny front ends and funny back ends too. One or two of us are anyway. So we'll have a look into that for you, and hopefully we'll report back on that one next week.
Kind of takes us back to the really cool interview that we did with Tony Foll. I don't know, 6 or so months back, because that gentleman is definitely into the funny front ends. And I always like seeing pushing the boundaries, race bike design. So really, really neat. Pretty cool.
Like the L4.
Yeah. Or there's so many, if you think about it. You know, there was a discussion that was going on this morning online, and people were kind of joking about the Yamaha GTS 1000. You remember that?
I do.
And, that certainly had a funny front end. Somebody popped up before I had the opportunity to remind people that what was essentially kind of a cruiser bike, more of a long distance tourer, that was ridden at the Isle of Man a couple of years in the TT, and I believe took a sixth in the Formula One race at least one year. So
that takes something special to do that.
And maybe a little bit crazy, but then again, you are on the Isle of Man at that point.
But for special, read crazy.
Yes. Some of our favorite people are that kind of special, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
Yep. I've also, it was interesting because we'd had the interview with Mark Miller, and then we had the one with
Brandon Craig. That was never, Jim, that wasn't an interview. We said this before. You don't interview Mark Miller. You just two buddies, you hook up and you chat and people just listening. It's great.
I listened back to it a couple of days ago and I was chuckling myself. Okay, we had a chat with Mark Miller and we had another one with Brandon Craig too, which really isn't so much either. because they're heading off to Macau and going to be riding the Buells. And so I put out a message and hopefully he will get it to Eric Buell, because I'd like to have him come on the show because, you know, they're going to be doing or going to be heading to World Superbike next year. Next year, of which is right around the corner. So I thought that would be cool.
It'd be interesting to hear what he's got to say. Most definitely. Absolutely. Very, very interesting character.
Yep, definitely. All right, carrying on. A gentleman named Alex wrote in. And Alex, I couldn't figure out your last name, so you are just Alex. And I took a piece out of his email. He says, I started watching racing about 13 years ago, and the very first race I saw was the AMA race at Laguna Seca. I instantly became a fan of the Ducatis and their awesome Spitfire-like noise and the cool dude Ben Bostrom. A lot has changed since I started watching racing, but I'm still a huge fan of MotoGP World Superbike and the AMA. I believe this year was the only year in when they had the MotoGP World Superbike and AMA races running at Laguna Seca. Weather was excellent in all races to realistically compare qualifying times. AMA was 1.6 seconds slower than World Superbike, and who in turn was 1.5 seconds slower than the MotoGP qualifying time. He goes on to say the amount of money spent in each series does not reflect the changes in lap times. It is hard to believe that an AMA machine is only 3.1 seconds slower than a prototype MotoGP machine. Now, I pulled this email, Dave, out from a bit ago. It was probably maybe a month and a half ago. Can't remember if it was pre or post World Superbike there. Well, it had to be post because he was talking about it.
Yeah, of course.
And as we know, we had a couple of AMA spec machines that ran in that. And they did quite well comparatively. And I used to go to Laguna Seca back when World Superbike ran there regularly, and we regularly had AMA wildcards running in it. My point being is that it's kind of difficult to compare lap times at, and I'm not hedging my bets here because people have heard me say this before, but to look at Laguna as a barometer on which bikes are quicker. Certainly, as motorcycle technology edges towards the top of the spectrum, and it's continuing to do so, and really has gone leaps and bounds in the last, say, 15 to 20 years, Laguna being the slowest track on the MotoGP circuit, or that was on the MotoGP circuit.
And the shortest lap.
Yep, and the shortest lap kind of lends itself to shrinking things down, if you will. And that was a hand gesture, which never works with radio. But you're essentially compressing the lap down, and the differences are going to be much more minor because of the shorter lap.
You were doing the thumb and the forefinger thing, weren't you?
No, I had both hands going.
Oh, both really. Hands?
Yeah.
Shrinking but it down that much?
It was a grand gesture that... Oh. that I'm sure people out there can visualize that.
Paint the picture.
I'm trying to, you know. Maybe I'll take a photo and I'll post it on the fan page. No, that would be rather pointless. Anyway, thank you for the email from both of you gentlemen. There were a few other ones that were in there, but I didn't manage to pull them all out because we do have a fair amount of news that's going on. And, of course, we had racing this last weekend, which Dave and I almost forgot. Not that it was a forgetful weekend, mind you. There were certainly some interesting things that occurred, and we're going to try and dredge them up from memory because I think I managed to jack up the show notes for that part. But in the meantime, there is some other news. Why don't you dive into that, sir?
Okay. The biggest news of the week is your compatriot, Ben Spies, retiring from competitive motorcycle racing, disappointingly. Citing a lack of fitness in the shoulder, which obviously we know he struggled with all year, only having a couple of rides and a free practice session on the Pramac Ducati. To be fair, he's knackered up both shoulders over the past couple of years. He'll probably end up focusing on his cycle racing team and other ventures that he's got, like restaurants, and who knows, maybe he'll stay involved in racing in some way because it's in his blood. He's done it since he was a toddler. And he said he was on the verge of accepting a deal to race with Ducati in World Superbikes before making the decision, which is an interesting statement, bearing in mind the news of later on for World Superbikes. So it's disappointing that Ben has to retire. Fantastic, fantastic rider. I don't think we ever really saw the best of him in MotoGP after his Tech 3 ride, especially with the season with Yamaha last year, that it must have hit him hard mentally. And then this year with the injuries, it's been a tough time for elbows. And hopefully we'll get him on the show in the not too distant future, and he can wax lyrical about it and his career in general, Jim.
Yeah, And my initial thought was to reach out and say, hey, dude, you know, come on the show. And then I said to myself, no, probably everybody's doing that right now. And maybe he just wants to chill out a bit. So I'll wait. And maybe we'll talk next month, which is right around the corner.
Yeah, or
sometime.
Isn't that the day after tomorrow?
That would be the day after tomorrow. Probably the day the show comes up. But we'll definitely get him back on and love to talk to him. We've always got things to talk about. I did see a story that was written. I think it was Superbike Planet and some quotes from Colin Edwards. Colin seemed pretty surprised about the whole thing. But at the same time, one of the things that he mentioned is, you know, there's no money in here anymore. And, you know, if you're not going to do it for a decent amount of money, then, you know, and we'll actually, that will lead into a bit that we're going to talk about in a while. All these things kind of interconnected. You know, the silly season is not done yet. Well, actually, it's probably going to kick off even more at this point.
Big time.
There was a seat that was left open by Bennett Pramac. That would be, his decision either to go to Ducati World Superbike, maybe hang around in MotoGP. But now that that spot is open, Pramac or Ducati or Factory Corso have decided to instead run that as an open category. So that is going to be kind of interesting. The rules for that are, who knows how tight they are at this point. We shall see. But not a factory bike like Cal, Debbie, and Andrea they'll have. We've got a short list right now that probably will change. Who knows? Because things still aren't set in stone within the MotoGP paddock. Danilo Petrucci and Hernandez are possibly on the short list. There could be a whole other raptor of names. We shall see.
Is this going to be like a version of the lab bike that Pirro was riding?
I think it might be.
So they can test it in racing.
Yeah, and we'll have to see. Frankly, Pirro did a pretty good job when he was riding that thing. So
absolutely, he did.
Yeah, whether they want to keep him on, have him continue to do a good job for testing duties, and certainly things are going to change there again because there have been changes within the squads as well. There's another short little note here that I don't know how much to give it as far as truthfulness or if it is a cinematic play on his part, but Matt Mladen threw Superbike Planet again. Apparently called Spies a fucking pussy for retiring. Now, who knows? They could both be laughing about it. Well, they were never the best of friends. In fact, you could go pretty far in the exact opposite direction, although they did have a lot of respect for each other. So I don't know what Matt is up to, but maybe he misses having his name on the world stage, if you will, because it certainly got a lot of people talking about it.
It's just popping his head above the parapet just to say hello.
Yeah, a way of blowing a metaphorical kiss. Carrying on. Go ahead, Dave.
Chaz Davis, who was offered a Ducati testing contract back in 07 and 08, and Davide Giuliano have both signed for Ducati for next season, both on a two-year contract. Not known yet who will run the Ducatis, as Altea have ended their relationship, but it seems likely that it's Phil Racing, who run the Goldbet BMW team this season, are the current favourites to head the team. This is a great move for Chaz. He's had a good season on that BMW this year. And anybody who can keep Melandri in check as a teammate absolutely deserves to take giant steps in the championship. And Giuliano as well has proved his worth this year. He's been entertaining to watch. Guaranteed top five week in, week out. And trying to shake off that tag as a crasher. Slowly, yep. But he's shaking it off all the same. I know some of the World Superbike teams have been testing down at Jerez today.
Right.
And it was Chaz's first ride out on the bike. And by all accounts and from contacts that we've heard from over there, it's looking like Chaz is going to be getting very comfortable on that Ducati very quickly.
Good. He tweeted a picture the other day of him sitting in what looked like a bookstore with a Ducati racer's table book.
That was his teaser, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it was very good. But our hope is that, unlike this year, that we don't see the Panigale get restricted right off the bat, that they can let the thing have its legs and keep it as a competitive machine.
I think that has, for the sake of the series, that has to happen. Otherwise, especially without the BMWs, without the powers of the factory BMWs, although we are hearing that there may well be a new BMW team arrive, subject to confirmation. We'll maybe know more about that next week. But that's running the HP4s, which are slightly more powerful than the RRs. Now, with Chaz doing what he's doing, Davide Giuliano, they need to let those Ducatis have their legs, or the BMWs and Kawasakis are just going to run away with it.
Although we have to say that Giuliano kind of the last half of the year did make a lot of good comebacks. he was one of those guys this year that Dave, that just every so often would just surprise the hell out of me. Be like, wow.
Yeah. He's been under the radar a little bit for a while, hasn't he? He's been sort of lower top 10. And then sort of this season, as we say, he's been finishing sort of top five. And I still think he along with, here's one, Chas Davies, Davide Giuliano, two of the best helmet designs in World Superbikes in the same team. Sorry, right. I know that's shallow, but I really love those two helmet designs.
Quite all right. We all have our little bits of shallowness, don't we?
You can't beat a good shiny helmet.
Exactly. Beto Guareschi is leaving, left Ducati at the end of this year, will be leaving, to instead manage Rossi's new Moto 3 team. And I don't think we've got all the riders specified for that yet. I know that he said at one point that his brother wasn't going to be on it, but we'll have to see how that goes. So that will be interesting, and yet another shakeup at Ducati Day.
Yeah, let's see what comes of that. They're replacing him with Gigi Delinea, the Aprilia man, with what Gigi's done to the Aprilia race bike, to the RSV4, if he can have his say on the Ducati and turn that into something a little bit special, then who knows, maybe Cal Crutchlow will be laughing at the fans rather than the fans deriding him for taking the ride.
It's an interesting, whatever happens there is going to be interesting to watch. There's no two ways about that. It'll be interesting to see how that trickles down and works with both themselves and Pramac with the Moan factory spec bike. Coming up on another bit of kind of weird news, and this one is a little bit sensitive. Some people out there are up in arms and some people are like, get over it. Mark had a very interesting helmet and t-shirt design at Motegi.
Oh man, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. It was one of those where you look at it and you go, is that really what I think it is?
Yeah. And we can describe it for you guys. It was basically Mark's a caricature of his face, attempting to make himself look Japanese by pulling the corners of his eyes back. It has been said that in Spain that some people wouldn't necessarily consider that to be an insult in any way, but there's other parts of the world where that kind of behavior is discouraged. And I actually saw something that was weird because I think the Spanish women's team had gone there, and all of the people on the basketball team did the exact same thing, and there was a bit of an uproar then too. At this point, I'm quite willing to say whatever.
I saw all the reaction on social media, and when I saw it, I just kind of you look at it and you go, really? And then he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. It's not that big a deal. Certainly not to me, but like you say, whatever. Each to their own.
This bit is interesting. You want to tackle this and I'll put in my 2 cents, which may be more than Colin gets.
Nice segue. It appears that Colin Edwards might not be getting paid next year. For the NGM forward squad, for them having to buy Alicia Spagaro off his Aspar contract has put the team in a bit of a tight spot, and Colin was asked to ride for free next year. Obviously he politely declined, and that there's no record of his actual response, but I really would pay good money to actually hear his response to that request.
I think I heard it from here. in a capital fuck no. But I'm certain that they will be able to work something out. There's a question of getting paid by the team you ride for, and getting paid through other means. And there's a lot of different means that the riders make money. But that being said, nobody wants to ride for free, especially not somebody of Colin's caliber and character.
Hell no.
We'll see how that pans out. Frankly, we may never hear anything, and in a way, it's, you know, I hate to say this because we do a show that we talk about MotoGP a lot, but it's almost nobody's business.
It's not, is it? I'm amazed it's made it into the public domain, because you very rarely hear of how riders get paid, what they get paid, and whether they get paid or not. That's usually that's one of the biggest natures of our sport in at all levels, is that nobody really knows who gets paid what. And like you're saying, they don't want to know how much I get paid for what I do. I don't want to know what they get paid for what they do.
I think the only obvious one that I've seen in the last few years where money talk was being bandied about was when Simon Buckmaster wrote a bit at the beginning of this year or the beginning of the prior year.
Beginning of the prior year. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was talking about how much it would cost to lease to get a spot on the PTR Honda team.
300,000 euros, if I remember right.
Something like that. But that was by far the most explicit. The rest of the people, you know, it's their business. They really don't want to talk about it too much.
No, as you say, it's not our business.
Yeah. And it there's no doubt that there are people riding for very little money. In some cases, none. I know of a few in the past, things that aren't my business to talk about in public either.
Of course.
Anyway, money, fucking money.
Who needs it?
We do. We're happy to take it.
Hit that donate button. Hit that subscribe button.
In other news, on the BSB front, there's a fair amount of things that are happening there, including what is written here. And I heard that Sealy is also nailed down. So why don't you fill me in on that from your side of the pond, sir?
Okay. Well, the Sealy season side has well and truly taken off. Obviously, it started a little bit earlier in September with the swapping around of Josh Waters from Milwaukee Yamaha to Household Racing and Tommy Bridewell going the other way. But things have sort of ramped up a little bit since in the week following Brands Hatch. It appears and is yet to be confirmed, but all the signs point to Taiko Suzuki, TT man, BSB man, Northwest 200, Josh Brooks. He's moving to Milwaukee Yamaha. Again, to run the roads, to run at BSB, and to have a full-on tilt at both. Making the way there is James Ellison. But the biggest news is, and it was confirmed about 24 hours ago, is that the dentist's dream, John Hopkins, he's back in British Superbikes with Taiko Suzuki. He's replacing Josh Brooks and is really looking forward to taking care of unfinished business, shall we say, from 2012.
But, you know, a bit of a surgeon's dream, too, over the years.
Yeah, very much so. In last season, too.
So that will be interesting. And I think...
It was 2011. Forgive me.
That was the, 0.006 second...
That's the one. And then he went with Crescent Suzuki to World Superbikes. So forgive me, listeners, before you start writing in. It's late. I've been up since 4:45.
No, by all means, write in. I don't think you've had any disparaging email yet, Dave.
No, I'm still waiting.
It'll come. Eventually, it will come.
I don't doubt that.
And I heard about Sealy as well. He got signed for in Supersport. I forget what team.
Yeah, he's going to the champions from this year, Martrain Yamaha.
Yeah.
The runners-up the season before with Jack Kennedy, who went off to World Supersport, delivered the championship this year with Stuart Easton. Great Northern Irish-based team. Nice team for him to do try the roads with as well. He does the Northwest 200 and he does a couple of the Irish rounds as well, the Ulster and Cookstown, I think. So a great base for Alistair Sealy to work on after losing out on the BSS crown to Easton. That'll be good for him. Let's see how he gets on there.
We're going to get you to head out to any of the real roads this year or in 2014, Dave.
I'd like to think so. I'd love to have a crack at the TT or the Northwest. So depending on how things go and depending on the contacts we have, hopefully we'll be out there for one of those.
I got lots of contacts. We'll see what we can do to have you on the ground for at least one or two of those. Alex Lowe's. We're not sure about this yet, are we?
I'm going to say no, but I'm nodding my head.
I like that.
This is a tricky one.
Well, then you take it. I want to see your take.
Alex is still under contract to Samsung Honda until the end of December. Mm-hmm. However, he's been out in Jerez testing the Crescent Suzuki today with Leon Camier. And by all accounts, he wasn't too far off Camier's pace either, considering Camier only rode there a couple of weeks ago. When we spoke to Paul Bird at Misano, when he intimated in that interview that there will be two British riders in his MotoGP team next year, he was talking about Alex Lowes. We spoke afterwards and he said, yes, I've signed Alex on a 2-year deal. I knew this before we went out there. So as he was telling me, I was mailing to him, I know who it is, which you don't pick up on the interview. But again, he was convinced that Alex was going to sign. And up until the end of last week, after Brands Hatch, I think the whole paddock was convinced he was going to go to Birdie's team. Rightly or wrongly, because it might have been a ride that he may have struggled with. It's not the high-profile ride that a BSB champion would look to take. They usually end up going to World Superbikes. Ka-ting! It all of a sudden comes to light. He's going to World Superbikes instead.
Shock, surprise, right?
Yeah, exactly. And silly season massively in full swing over here. It's difficult trying to keep up with everything. But yes, he will be on the Crescent Suzuki next year.
That is why I handed that bit to you, Dave.
Yeah, so I get, so that's it. So when people ring up giving the shit saying, you've dropped the story, thanks very much, it's all going to come back to me. Great.
Well, you'll hear about it on Twitter first, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Now, we did put it out the other day that he was going, so it's fine.
All good. Yeah, and then Harry had put some notes in here about a potential Suzuki ride in 2015. But Harry said he thought that might be a dog of a bike. And I'm like, dude, it could be a great machine. You know, we're not going to know until it gets here. And testing is still going on with that.
Yeah, right? That's Harry, you know better than that.
Yeah, yeah. Don't,
I'll tell you why he's done that. That's because I had a playful dig at him the other week for not having an opinion and sitting on the fence.
You know, it's funny. By the way, you guys did a stellar job with the show the other day.
That's very kind. Thank you very much.
Really well done. Really well done. Sometimes I don't get to hear them right off the bat. They go out there and I'm like, God, I hope they did great. And then I'll listen back to it a couple of days later. And I'll go, of course they did. What was I thinking?
it's the strangest sensation keeping myself company on the way down to Brands Hatch on the Saturday dinner time, listening to me and Harry. And then listening to your chat with Mark Miller and Brandon, it was just the strangest thing.
Are you used to hearing yourself yet?
I am now. Yeah, I'm a lot happier with it now than in the early days.
Yeah. Well, eventually there's going to come a point where you're going to go, oh my God, did I really say that?
I've had a couple of those already.
Yeah. Well, as long as other people aren't saying it as well. More news. And I thought this one was funny, and this one did not surprise me at all, but boy, did it get it hit the launching pad and went off. Not unusual in the instant news field that we have today, you know, where everything gets around very quickly. But Josh Hayes was spotted in Motegi. Well, he kind of knows a lot of guys that are there, but so was
Gary Johnson. But nobody went and blabbed about that, did they?
Well, that's Gary.
he was on the grid. He was taking photos of Marquez like a true fanboy.
I'm going to have to go back and watch that grid walk. I missed that.
He was there.
I wonder if he's going to stick over there he's practically halfway to Macau right now. I wonder if he's just making a long trip out of it.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. Yeah, he's definitely out for Macau.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and he's a bit of a TV hog anyway.
That handsome face of his.
Yeah. There's a picture that I have to send you that's funny as hell. Carrying on, though. Yeah, Josh was spotted in Motegi. It was rumored, and boy, was it rumored, that he was testing the new R1 for World Superbike, maybe do some races over there or all sorts of stuff. And that thing just went ballistic. Well, as it turns out, RoadRacingWorld.com got a hold of him. He said yesterday, I went to Japan. Woo!
So
yeah. I understand everyone is interested in hearing some interesting news, but the truth of the matter was I went there to hang out with my buddy Cal Crutchlow and watch the MotoGP race at Motegi.
Shock horror. Rider goes to race meeting to watch races.
Yeah. Now, Josh, if you hear this, and you probably will because I'm saying it, I know maybe, perhaps you have something in the bag, but you're usually pretty damn honest when somebody asks you a particular question, especially if it's, you know, a John O'Rourke of the world. So I'm going to tend to believe you. I hope you're having a great time in Japan. The weather is cleared up, which I hear it has.
It couldn't have been any worse, could it?
Yeah. And hopefully you took your lovely wife over there because I think your 6-year anniversary just came past. So, yeah, anyway, the speed of rumors, they're amazing. News on my front, sir. MJM or Michael J. Jordan Motorsport has pulled out of AMA after a very, what's the term I'm looking for? A difficult year, shall we say here. Great racing. The racing was good. But the management and let's just say the management of the series was not on a par that we would like to see. And in fact, you know, it's interesting right now, Dave, that there's a lot of comparisons going on here in the States between BSB, which to us is being managed brilliantly, although most American fans don't really understand the ins and outs of BSB management. Maybe I think I probably do a little bit more than most. But otherwise, a very successful series with some great riders coming out and a great TV contract, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, over here in the States, it's not been so good. In fact, we're not only shedding riders heading over to international series, which is good. That's a progression, right?
Yeah.
But shedding teams is a little bit more difficult. And the grids have been shrinking a little bit anyway. That being said, for MJM, there is talk now. I've seen two different interviews having been done with Keith, the PR man for that team, that they're talking about in 2015 of hitting either World Superbike or MotoGP. Easier said than done. It still costs money and serious money to do so. Now, that being said, Michael Jordan and his company have a lot of it. Whether they want to focus in on other ventures is a question. One of the big reasons, by the way, is that their sponsor left them, that being National Guard here.
Yeah, of course.
In the States. So that will also affect, by the way, and we'll have to see what effect it has. And I guess I could call Barry Gilson and find out. Lovely Irish lad running an American team here. Celtic Racing, with James Rispoli and company in the Daytona sport bike class, our equivalent of your super sport class.
Yeah, sure. Just on that note, Jim, what's your take on the renaissance of American riders recently? Hayes apparently testing the 2015 Yam after a good season. You've got James Rispoli there. You've got Josh Herron at Caterham. We've had PJ Jacobson this year, who's been a fantastic find for Taiko Suzuki. All right, a little bit of a struggle in the early rounds on tracks he didn't know, but those last four rounds, he was up there, and you know, he looked the real deal. And on a side note to that, he's not going to be in BSB next year. He's going off to either World Supersport or Moto2 after testing one of the World Supersport Kawasaki's immediately after the Hereth World Superbike meeting.
Right. But,
what's your thoughts on the you've got quite a decent amount of talent coming out there at the moment.
We do. And there is our feeder system here in the States to bring kids up to the national series or beyond is a little bit different than, say, Spain or the UK for that matter. Well, a lot different than Spain, because Spain, basically, motorcycle racing is a national sport where people are absolutely dedicated to it and the government supports it, right?
Yes.
If you look at our national series, we basically have four classes, and they're classes that aren't necessarily, with the exception of super sport, a good stepping stone, in my opinion. This is my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
From the classes that are prior to that, we do have still some 125 racing that goes on through USGPRU. There are an awful lot of small mini bike series that are scattered around the country. One of the things that I think that we lost was we had our own Red Bull Rookie Cup for a while, if you remember. Yep. And it only lasted for a few seasons and unfortunately disappeared. Money. I think we're always going to have talent coming up. The question is, can it be nurtured enough? And can the parents afford it without having real young sponsorship like we can see in some other nations?
Yeah.
I think that with the amount of people that we have here and the amount of racetracks that we have here in the States, that we'll always be seeing good American racers come up. It's a question of the racing infrastructure to be able to support that. And that has me a bit worried right now.
I met a couple of guys when I was out in Missouri, young Joe Roberts and Anthony Alonso, two American guys running in, well, nine guys, bless them, they're only 15 and 16, running in the Red Bull Rookies Cup. But I see that this year they're not running in that championship. So it'll be interesting to see where they end up, because they were a couple of fast kids.
Yeah, I think over the last few years, I think Joe Roberts is probably one name we're really going to want to watch out for. And I think we'll see him pop up on somebody's team at the international level very soon.
Yeah, he was the older of the two. And I think that was his second year in the series. And I think that was only Anthony's first. But he hasn't made the grade, or he hasn't raised the necessary funds to carry on.
Yeah, I chatted with Joe at a race sometime this year, and maybe Laguna, can't remember. But definitely a kid with his head on his shoulders and some very good, wise backing behind him, people that actually know the international racing business. So look to see him. Anthony Alonso is a good kid too. He's a Bay Area, relatively local to me. And I think that we will see something coming out ahead. You know, Joe Roberts came back to the States and ran some races in the National Series and immediately came in and kicked everybody's ass. So I think he's got good prospects. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, as it is, I'm a little bit worried about domestic racing. There are a lot of people that want to do something about it. The question is, can they get the sponsorship and the corporate backing and the backing of the manufacturers to try and bring it back to the way that it was before? Because we've had a very strong national series in the past, and I'd like to see that come back again.
Yeah, I mean, we used to get it over here. We used to get both races live, and when the Bostroms with the Haydens and Aladdin and Spies before he went off, it was great racing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, is the racing is still great. It's just that the stuff surrounding it is not so good.
The racing is great. It's just nobody can fucking see it.
Yeah. All right. MotoGP, I haven't heard this, and I'm not sure where Harry sourced it from, but he mentions that the Brazil round might be canceled. Perhaps that's because of they can't get their FIM homologation for the track, but they tested there, so I'm not sure what the deal is.
No, that's a new one on me, Jim. I can't shed any light on that one, unfortunately.
All right, so everybody needs to write in and ask Harry, who's trying to figure out how to read his email from Motopod. Which I think is kind of funny.
That would be a great. That's a great exercise. Everybody write into Harry and let's just deluge his email, his inbox, and see if it works.
That would be Harry at Motopod or Motopodcast.com.
That's the one.
Yeah. And then I heard today that Casey Stoner has been testing 3 days worth the 2013 and 2014 RCV 213Bs. At the Sugo circuit, apparently under sunny skies until the third day, midway through the day, but they'd finished their testing they needed to do. He was not testing the production racer. I think Takeshi Takahito, that might be the name, or I might be butchering it, was testing the production racer, but that is still apparently on track for the 2014 season. I pish-pished that bike for so long that I'm looking forward to see it. I'm hoping that it will shut me up.
Would Sir like ice cream, or would Sir like double cream with his humble pie?
Yeah. Thank you very much. but, you know, we've been hearing so much about a V4 production racer for years and years and years and years and years that at a certain point I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. When you go back so far in racing, it's been around for a long time. So some of the new guys to racing, they go, oh, that'll be great. And when you've been around as long as we have, you go, yep, been there, heard that, still waiting to see it.
I think I want a nice 8-frame, the covers of MCN when they put out their new V4 from Honda. They would do that every year, wouldn't they? Yep. New concept drawings?
Yep, that they knocked up around the back on Photoshop. Brilliant. Yep.
All right. So that is mostly of the news that we've had over the last week. We did have a race this last week, and I'm still laughing. Let's talk about the pre-event, what we had going into it, Dave. Obviously, we had a lot of guys coming in from Phillip Island. Very important if you're going to be attending the next race.
it helps.
I just wanted to say that. Knowing Scott Redding was damaged goods coming in. Brattle, same as well. Both guys were cleared to race. Weather was definitely going to be a factor at this race, and especially so at the location that Motegi is in. They are up in the mountains. I'm not sure what the altitude is there. I don't think it's real high, but they have had weather issues in the past. We've seen it many times.
Massively.
Yep. So that was kind of the way that we went into the weekend of. And weather-wise, it certainly didn't disappoint to the point where nothing happened on Friday.
Apart from an extended grid walk and a lot of very happy Japanese fans from that perspective.
Yeah, I got to listen to David Emmett Nick Harrison, thank you. You're going to leave me dangling in the breeze there for a while. Sorry, Nick. Going on and on and on and on and on about helicopters, frankly, and I was hoping Martin would pop in and help us out here, but the helicopters were grounded because of a low ceiling, and this, basically, these are the medical helicopters, and they have to be functional in order for any people to get out on track at speed, and yes. They basically couldn't take off from where they were stationed, which was about 5 minutes from the circuit. Even though they tried, apparently, a couple of times, they couldn't take off and get to the circuit, nor would they be able to take off from the circuit and get to Mito, where the hospital was. So without having the capability in this mountainous region, the capability of getting the riders to the nearest available high-level medical facility, they had to hold off doing anything. And so what we got was a bunch of talking heads. That being said, Nick and Gavin, you did a brilliant job for talking much ado about nothing.
Yeah, that's the hardest part of the commentary game when there's not a great deal happening, and in Friday's case, nothing happening at all, apart from discussing dismantling a helicopter and trying to bring it in by road and then reassembling it at the track just so that they could go. Which, how much truth was in that, I don't know. I think that's pretty much firmly tongue in cheek. But
I'm not sure. I think they actually thought about doing. I think they were pretty close to doing it.
Oh, dear. There's things to do and things not to do, and that really pleased no. But after the tire debacle at Phillip Island, the rumours that two guys were running away from the circuit in Bridgestone shirts with fog machines is apparently unfounded.
That's a good one. you just made that up, didn't you? I'll leave it at that. Basically Friday was nothing. What it reminded me actually with Gavin and Nick was the rainout at Qatar four or 5 years back, where they had to do the exact same thing, only at night. So there's even less to look at.
not the most scenic racetrack in the world.
Yep. So Saturday morning dawned, at least down in the flatlands, relatively clear, although additional rain was expected and did show up. And so Saturday mornings, the first sessions all through midday Saturday got canceled. And in fact, we thought nothing was going to happen. And in the end, we did get a little bit of Saturday afternoon. But at that point, the schedule was so, I believe the term I'm looking for is foobarbed.
Well and truly.
Yeah. But things were not going well. I will say with that, Dorna, I think, did a masterful job of figuring out how to get the schedule pulled back together again, even though there were a lot of people that weren't happy about it. What are you going to do? We got to get a race going.
Yeah. Extended qualifying was a great time. I'm sure they've done that in recent years previously and gone for a 75-minute qualifying session. So you can use the bulk of the time to find a bit of setup. Everybody's in the same boat, so nobody's gaining any advantage over anybody else. So you all use the time wisely, and then the next 20 minutes, haul ass and get your qualifying position.
The downside to that was that there was still a lot of standing water on the track, and predictions for Sunday were dry. And so whatever they got done as far as qualifying goes and setting the bike up, they were still going to have to turn around in an extended morning session and not do it all again, but make sure that whatever settings they had from prior seasons or not at all were modified to fit what was predicted and turned out to be a dry track.
Well, with the extended qualifying sessions and the extended warm-up sessions and the rain from the Saturday and the dry sessions on the Sunday, it actually didn't make a huge difference to who was going to be running at the front come Sunday afternoon. The qualifying session for the Moto3, it was Alex Rins who snatched the pole position. But it's quite a yawning chasm of a gap because of the weather. 0.9 of a second ahead of Maverick Vinales, Alex Marquez, Luis Salom, and Jack Miller, with cousin Isaac Vinales heading up in sixth place. So it was still the usual suspects at the front, but there was a fair old time gap between them, which has been unusual this season. But as we said, it was weather orientated, so that can be forgiven. And then come the race, it was a debut win for the allegedly faster of the Marquez brothers, Alex Marquez's debut win in the series.
Brilliant. That race kind of portended for the way the rest of the weekend was, or the rest of the day was going to be going for a lot of other riders, because it was, I believe the term haphazard.
That's a good word to use.
Definitely applied. I don't remember a whole lot of the Moto3 race because I was so highly anticipating what was going to be going on later. And those certainly didn't disappoint. But we did have a few lads out of that one. And when I say a few that were kind of, well...
title contenders.
Thank you. Moto3, as usual, didn't disappoint, but there were some surprises. You can walk through that if you want to.
Luis Salom, the biggest... Yeah. The biggest shock of the weekend, the fact that he crashed, he was knocked off. I forget who the errant flying was. It Vasquez, I can't quite remember.
I think it might have.
Is it he high sided and nearly took his nearly knocked his head off as he came flying past with an errant boot. Got back up, dusted himself off. And unfortunately, it wasn't enough to get him back into the points. And then a few laps later, he high-sided himself out of the race and rang his bell and took no further part. So to continue that, Alex Rins obviously saw the glory of the race win coming, his biggest title rivals out of the race. He's chasing down Marquez and Vinales at the front, and then he goes and throws his bike at the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Hold on. Stand up, take a bow, lose 2 minutes, then realize you can actually get back on your bike and get back out on the racetrack and try and steal a few points towards the end. But it wasn't to be for Alex Rins. It now goes down to Valencia. With Marquez taking a win from Vinales, from Jonas Folger. And as we look at the standings, Salom leads with 300 points, but only 2 points behind now after dropping the points at Motegi is Maverick Vinales. And then Alex Rins is a further 3 points back from Vinales. So we have 5 points covering the top three, three Spaniards on almost identical bikes going into a race in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Start, fire up the wreckers.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's going to be a hell of a race. That's going to be a race of attrition. And if all three finish, then I'll be amazed.
And our first championship that we knew was going to be coming down to Valencia.
Yes.
Yep. Moto 2, of course. And watch your hands there, Dave. I know you're getting excited.
Well, I was before Phillip Island. I'm not so excited now.
Yeah. Well, we shall see what Valencia brings. Not the most exciting circuit, but at least we have a championship or two to see what's going to be going on there. Moto 2.
Mika Kallio.
Mm-hmm.
Pole position for the Mark VDS team. Again, in unusually crap conditions, but a bit tighter on the qualifying for this one. Javier Simeon was second on the grid from Johann Zarco and Simone Corsi. Susipto, QMF racing team, up into fifth place on the speed up in qualifying. It's always good to see a different name up there.
He led qualifying for about the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did well. Ended up only half a second back from Kallio, from Rabat and Espargaró. Poor old Scott Redding, there's a bit of English jingoism, 15th on the grid. Which is a bit of a shame. Obviously, with his broken wrist from Phillip Island, it was always going to be a big ask. He was never not going to try and ride, but unfortunately, with the nature of the injuries, he was never going to be able to fight to the level that he needed to prevent Paul taking the championship. Great qualifier from Gino Rea in 14th, and Danny Kent getting his best of the season in 9th place on the Tech 3.
I always enjoy it when I have one of you guys on because I get the full placement of all of the writers from the UK.
Absurf. 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 Fucking lovely.
And ladies and gentlemen, Dave Neal.
I'm here all week.
So, yeah. Once again, that, of course, was in, shall we say, marginal conditions. They, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but Moto2 qualifying came third in the series on Saturday afternoon. So they ended up having kind of a wet, dry track. Was that not correct?
Yeah, that's been the case for quite a few of the rounds this year, that it goes Moto3, MotoGP, Moto2. And
right.
It was no different at Japan this weekend.
Yeah, and they near the end of it, they had a fair amount of drying going on the circuit. But as it turned out, there were still enough wet patches for them to keep the tires cold. I was wondering about that as it was going on. One of the things that I did notice about Scott Redding was the last couple of laps when he was coming down the front straight. He actually had his left wrist kind of laying on the triple clamp. As he was coming down there, I said, yeah, that's going
to
hurt.
So onto the Moto2 race itself. And it was always going to be the story of Paul Espargaró and when he was going to win the title and where he was going to finish. And Paul being Paul and being the competitor that he is and a worthy world champion. God, that hurt. He took the bull by the horns, and after a steady start, he hunted the front pairing down of Kallio and Luthi, picked them off one by one, opened the gap, and just held the gap to the line. A great champion's ride from Paul, cheered on by his brother on the sideline, kissing his necklace and shaking his fist and getting all Spanish and excitable. Mika Kallio carrying on his good work from qualifying and bringing the Mark VDS racing team Kallex home in second place from the Swiss Thomas Luthi on the Interveten Paddock Moto2 bike on the Suter. Javier Simeon backing up his qualifying with fourth place from Julian Simon, Nicholas Tirol, Alex De Angelis, Dominic Agurta, Taka Nakagami. I did love saying that. I love his name. And Mattia Pessini. Yeah. So a worthy championship win for Paul. And just talking of Thomas Luthi, I'm not sure if it was in the press conference afterwards or somebody had spoken to him in the week. They asked him what the best thing about being Swiss was. He said, well, it has its good and bad points. He said, but the flag's a real big plus.
I love that. That is awesome.
He didn't, but it was just me because Thomas Lutie's there.
Oh, damn. I was appreciating that.
I'm sorry to piss on your firework.
But that being said, lap one was not all wine and roses.
No, unfortunately not. No, we had we had to have the restart. Unfortunately, we lost Esteve Rabat, Alex Marina Larena, and Scott Redden, sadly. Rabat lost control of his 20 HP40 Calex. Unfortunately, collecting Marina Larena, and with Scott Redden's 15th place start, had nowhere to go and was just launched straight over the top of his bike after clobbering Esteve Rabat on the way through, who was fortunate to get away uninjured with that. It was quite a whack. And basically he landed straight onto his bad wrist, and he rolled and rolled, and he was on the track for a good few minutes. He was conscious, but he was hurting. And sadly, that was the end of, if he was going to mount a championship charge, which was unlikely, that was the end of any prospects he had of lifting the Moto2 World Championship.
Yeah, certainly took the air out of his sails, such as they were. And we were all obviously very concerned for, and well pronounced, I'll give it my shot, Marina Larena. Because the time it took the medical team to get him stabilized and out of there was very concerning. So from what I've heard now, he seems to be doing well. So
and again, similar to the Sepang incident with Axel Pons wasn't involved in this one.
Shock, surprise, once
there's
again.
A first.
He finished the race. And he finished in the points.
No.
Ahead of your boy, Gina Ray.
Well, would you look at that? I thought that was a typo. Sorry, Alex. Axel, Alex, whichever way you are this weekend.
Moto 2. That being said, he got quite the hero's welcome back home. Both he and his brother Elish shared the spotlight to a teeming crowd in his hometown, and good on him.
I know he beat Scott to the title, but all joking aside, he's ridden so well this year, and he deserves that championship. And they did a little montage after the race, and just actually, if he can transfer that style to a MotoGP bike the same way that Marc Marquez has, he's going to go so well on that Yamaha next season.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. We shall see. It sounds to me like after a day or two to think about it, that Scott is ready to put that aside and get on with business. I think he was a little bit devastated, but at the same time, it's not like he didn't accomplish something amazing this year. And so props to him.
Yeah,
as well.
Absolutely. You look at the season as a whole, it just to be up there, and for a guy of his size to be fighting, mm-hmm. to even be in with a chance of fighting for the championship is a hell of an achievement. And he, like you say, he can take a lot of props out of this year, take that forward onto the production Honda with Gresini, and be proud of what he's achieved this year. It just wasn't meant to be. That's racing. He knows that. And his team know that. You get over the devastation. And he's had more devastating things to deal with in his short career than that. And he's dealt with them masterfully. So he'll take the learning curve out of it. He'll take that forward, and it'll make him a stronger rider next year.
I agree. And on top of that, it really does give a boost to the Mark VDS team in a way. And we always appreciate the wry humor of one Ian Wheeler and company.
such a great guy.
he's fun and funny.
And our people are still talking to his people about actually getting him on the show.
You know,
that's been going
on
18 months, Jim.
Trust me, it's been going on longer than that, my friend. What he does, Ian, if you're listening or not, is he'll tell you, "Oh yeah, okay," and you get your hopes up, and then he just fades off into the sunset.
chuckling.
He's been doing that for, yes, Chipperly, been doing that for a long time. MotoGP, the round that we were looking for, not necessarily the results we were looking for. Well, I don't know. Were they? We still, because of what happened, we still get one more race that actually means something for MotoGP this year.
And that's down to the tenacity and the application of one Jorge Lorenzo. Nothing more.
Who should be actually named the robot after that performance. Oh,
just an incredible. The last three rounds, he's just been fantastic. You know, he's not not exciting. It's not the right word. He's not as help me out, Jim. I can't think of the word.
Excitable.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of his riding style. He's not as aggressive and as moving around as animated. There we go. That's the word. Yep. He's not as animated on the bike as Marc Marquez. But to actually, if rather than just looking at the races, if you actually watch Jorge Lorenzo in action, he's just a dream to watch. He doesn't move around so much. All right, he's not hanging off. He is dragging his elbow in a few cases now. But because his body movement isn't quite as exaggerated, there's the other word I was looking for.
Yes, he's very subtle.
Yeah, exactly. It's subtle movements. And although I know we'll get onto the race in a second or two. But
Oh, no. Martin's loving this. Keep carrying on.
The Jorge Lorenzo Appreciation Society is in the house. But to actually watch him, and I made a point of this on Sunday, because it was not the most exciting race we've ever had from start to finish. But I actually found the race fascinating in the contrast in styles between Lorenzo and Marquez. And I haven't really, that's more in detriment to me than anybody else. I haven't actually taken a lot of notice of that this year. But this was the first GP where they were far enough apart towards the end that we can actually watch them and go, do you know what? Jorge Lorenzo is absolutely in the ascendancy. Yeah. And he's been there. He's done it. He just knows what he has to do. He has to just hit that mark. He has to go as fast as he possibly can, which is the aim of the game. It's racing, I know. But to override the bike, but not to the point where he's going to lob it down the road. And he's just, he's so perfect and so smooth. He is on the verge of boring, Martin.
I guess the synopsis of it is he's done exactly what he had to do and no more.
No question. Absolutely no question. He cannot do any more than he's done. He's hit pole position. He's hit fastest laps and he's hit 25 points. What more can he do?
Right. I can tell you what he can do. He can, in 8 days' time, pick up another win at Valencia, which he pretty much has to do, or that would be very helpful, because he does have one Marc Marquez still with the points lead, and so yeah. Marc needs.
But it's not as much as it was three races ago. It's going the right way.
Nope. Yep. Well, Phillip Island didn't hurt his chances either.
Oh dear! No, don't think we. No, I'm not going to go down that road. You covered that island supremely well.
No backtracking at this point.
No, always looking forward.
That was a tough show to do, trust me.
I don't doubt it. That's why do you think I chickened out? No, I was busy, genuinely.
Okay. Weather wasn't necessarily an issue. We did have a couple of gentlemen go out, one who was extremely unhappy about it occurring, that being Aleix Espargaró. But Lucas Gasset and Lucas Paycheck were out relatively early in the race. Your top five were Jorge Lorenzo, Marc Marquez, Danny Pedrosa, Alvaro Bautista, and Stefan Bradl. Now, from what I heard, Dave, that's the first time in the Premier class we've had four Spaniards in the top four spots.
Yeah, I'd read the same. We've had three Spaniards on the top step all season, nearly, apart from the odd errant Italian appearing there. I think that's I seem to have read the similar thing that, first time for four Spaniards, which, you know, props to Alvaro Bautista for hauling his ass into fourth place. He's been threatening a lot just lately. And for the guys chasing him to actually finish the race, he hasn't done it because the other guys failed to finish. He's done it on merit.
One of the things that I have to wonder about Bautista, because as the season has gone on, I've consistently said that I'm very impressed with his advance through the field, and his even though we kind of joke about his crash efforts in the past, and he's still crashing, but he's not crashing into other people at the moment, which
that's
is
always a good thing.
Yeah, is the amount of advancement that's going on with that bike, because they're the only ones on the grid, or maybe one of just a couple that are running the Nissan brakes in the
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and to bring it home in fourth place is showing that if there are other teams out there looking to run the production Honda next year, if they want to go Nissan and they want to go Showa over Brembo and Ohlins, which are obviously the more expensive. And if people are trying to keep costs down, the Nissan and the Showa are competitive.
Right. Well, competitive with the modifications that that team and the Honda engineers are putting into them. And, you know, I haven't even read or I can't remember from the specifications of the production Honda, but I wouldn't be surprised if that thing was challenging any of the factory bikes if they didn't decide to equip it with Showa and Nissan.
They haven't built that to come 10th, have they? It's Honda.
Yeah.
They've built that to challenge the Tech Threes of this world.
Right. So we shall see. But once again, a great... And, you know, Bautista's been battling it for the fourth position for quite some time.
And it's contract time as well, so he needs to be up there.
Right. I think they'll keep him around.
I think so too.
Back through the rest of the top 10, Valentino Rossi in a sixth place in a relatively, not a lonely one, a couple of seconds off of Stefan Bradl. Cal Crutchlow, Bradley Smith, Nicky Hayden, and Andrea Dovizioso. Of note, in 11th, and a man that's done very well at this circuit and also very well in the WIT, Katsuyuki Nakasuga, the test rider.
Good ride for him. It was good to see him back out there.
Yeah, well, you remember the second position last
year? Absolutely, exactly.
Yeah. On down the line, Colin Edwards, Depunier, Iannone, and Hernandez in the points, and so on and so forth. And then one thing that I did notice, unless there's more you want to talk about specifically about the race itself, was it an awful lot of people stuck around in Japan afterwards? nobody ran home real quick.
No, there wasn't a big queue at the airport, was there?
No. And so people were out having a great time. Not only the people within the paddock, but I saw a fair amount of people that had traveled there for that race outside of it. And there were a lot of frivolity and stuff going on before the 2 weeks were over to the battle at Valencia, which is once again coming up in 7 or 8 days.
I was party to a conversation between Ian Wheeler and Gavin Emmett and Azzi Farni in Mark VDS Hospitality. And they were discussing the relative merits of the cage. And I see that was mentioned a few times over the weekend, especially on Sunday evening. Mr. Wheeler tweeting about half pints of vodka from being bought from Mika Kallio and onto the cage for karaoke, I believe.
We saw more than a few smiles from Mika this weekend. Pole position in Moto2, second spot. He had every right.
Yeah. Mika Kallio was smiling. He was smiling. It wasn't wind. He was smiling.
Yeah. Well, he also had, in a way, at the end, at the end of QP, when he was being interviewed by Gavin Emmett, he got this look on his face that was like, pole position, bitches. I was like, well done. I think I got a screen capture of that. It was a great look on his face.
You just raise the one eyebrow. You look at the screen and you go, thank you. Check me out.
You know what we should do, because we kind of forgot about it, is let's run, first off, your interview with Tommy Aquino. Because that does relate back a bit, that was at Brands.
Yeah,
correct?
It was. Yeah, that was on the final evening.
Right.
And it was dry. It wasn't raining for the first time that weekend.
Funny. Then we'll run Temples of Speed, and then we'll come back and bid you all adios. Or, I guess adios would be appropriate since we're heading to Valencia.
That would work.
All right. Interviews in 3, 2, 1.
Dave Neil from Motopod. We're in the paddock. It's starting to get dark. Been a great day at Brands Hatch. Stood here with Tommy Aquino, one of the American visitors to the series in the British Superstock 1000. First season in British Superstock, visiting from California. Have you enjoyed your first season?
Oh, I have. It's been an experience. I've gone to many new tracks that I could never even imagine, like, you know, Gadwell and Alton, and, you know, been to some of the historic ones like Donington and Silverstone, and, you know, I've had a really good season, and I'm just lucky to come away with quite a few top fives and a couple podiums and a win, and, you know, we've done really well for our first season in England.
Early doors, finding your feet with the bike and the team and the track, of course. Brands Hatch Indy, first time out, glorified roundabout. How was that for you, first time out?
I mean, when we got here on Wednesday, it was snowing. Like, I didn't know what I got myself into, honestly. I was actually scared. Like, oh, God, what did I get myself into? It's snowing. I thought it would be raining at every round, but... coming from California, we don't really get a lot of rain. We don't ride in the rain, even if it does. So I was just in for it, just like, you know, today and today's race. This is pretty much the first rain race we've had.
Yeah, it was. It was the first round of the season where we've had rain. Usually for the British Superbike Championship, there's rain every other round. But we've had a really good season for it. And going back into the sunshine, Cadwell Park. You got some good memories from there?
Yeah, obviously Cadwell is going to be stuck in my mind for a long time. It was my first BSB win, so, I mean, I love that track. It's just excellent, so nice, and it's really flowing once you actually get a rhythm, and, you know, the mountain is special, but the rest of the track is just as exceptional.
It's a good track. It's a natural track as well. It's not a man-made one. It follows the parkland and obviously the mountain side of it as well. When you got to the mountain for the first time, what were your thoughts?
I thought it was really cool. I mean, coming from a motocross background, I mean, second lap at Cadwell Park, I already got some air, so I enjoyed it a lot.
Excellent. It's one of the few places where people go, they'll either go, great, I love this, or they look at it and they go, shit. Yeah. What am I supposed to do with this? But moving on, you've been successful. You've been top tens, top fives. Close the season off now. What does the off season hold now for Tommy Aquino, and where are we going next year?
Well, I mean, just this first little bit of off season, I need to find out what I'm doing for next year, and then start looking for sponsors and whatnot, and then start training as soon as possible, and hopefully we'll be back and with Team WD-40 in Superbike. Excellent. Or Superstock or whatever they can do, because they want to move up, and
they're a great outfit to do that.
The series needs some more bikes and Superbikes, so it would be good, but I mean, it's a lot of money and we need some help, so
yeah. There's everybody. Yeah,
it'll take a little bit, so we'll see.
Okay. I've seen Jeff Crust here this weekend. Obviously you came over on Jeff's recommendation. Has he been helping you out with bits and pieces through this year?
Jeff has really helped out. He's pretty much been my coach all year. I mean, he's watched me on track, come back and said, well, you know, it looks like you or the bike are doing this, and, you know, the guy that's going fastest is doing this, and, you know, he's really helped me a lot, and it was his recommendation via Wayne Rainey, and, you know, I'm just really happy to have been here this year.
Nice to have the backing of a former Marlboro Yamaha boss and the former Marlboro Yamaha three-time world champion, people looking out for you.
Yeah, no, it is really nice. So I'm really privileged to have been on their minds and just got the opportunity to be here. So, I'm really happy with the way the season went. I wish we could have pulled off a better result today, being the final, but... I just need some more
laps.
It's
just been raining buckets today. Just been one of those awful days. There's been rivers across the track. It's been wet. It's been dry. Yeah. It's been drying. The worst conditions for a race.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's scoring 2 points is better than crashing and scoring none. So yeah,
bring it home.
Yeah, we brought it home, and hopefully we can get some more points next year.
Bring in next year.
Maybe a few more.
Tommy, thank you very much indeed. Enjoy the off season, and look forward to seeing you back next season.
Thank you.
The Temples of Speed, Episode 5, The Low Countries. In the northwestern corner of Europe, in the area historically known as the Low Countries, there are two temples of speed that are intrinsically woven into the tapestry of the Grand Prix history of motorcycle racing. Though in terms of the Blue Ribbon classes, they reside at opposite ends of the spectrum. One hasn't hosted MotoGP for over 20 years, yet still thrives as a venue. The other has steadily built its reputation right from 1925 and is the only place to proudly boast its uninterrupted participation in Grand Prix since the birth of the championship in 1949. We'll start in northern Holland, in the region of Drenthe, when officials of three small towns took advantage of the Dutch government's decision to allow public roads racing a year previous by running an 18-mile clockwise triangle connecting Rold, Borger and Schoonloo, passing through Rollo. Poor Dutch pronunciation notwithstanding, this was a fast, narrow challenge that was originally unpaved in some places. That year, a Norton won at an average speed of just over 56 miles per hour. You can still trace most of the circuit around these towns, but unless you know what you're looking for, there isn't many clues. With growing interest, the organisers wanted to pave larger sections, but the officials of Borger wouldn't agree. So a new venue was sought and found south of Assen, which was paved, though with bricks in some areas. At over 10 miles long, this was wide, quick and challenging, with the trait of fast kinks leading to faster straights already apparent. This version of Assen kicked off with the Dutch entry only in 1926, with a less-than-expected crowd turning up, though they came when the following year it was granted international status. 3 years later, the event gained classic status, and in 1936, the Dutch TT was officially registered, the only race permitted to use the TT name other than the island. Like most circuits, 1939 to 1945 brought a lapse, with racing continuing in 1946. In 1955, demands on the surrounding roads infrastructures led to a new circuit being built largely alongside and replicating the original ribbon of tarmac where possible, this reducing the length to 7.7 kilometres, or 4.8 miles. Whilst the circuit's fast and close to the crowd nature has gradually been reduced, it is safe to say much of the track's fast and flat character remains, though many purists were miffed when the S-bocht, or S-corner, the flippy first combination, was curtailed and wound out tighter to get to the famous Distrubben slow left-hander before a supreme test of skill as riders increased speed and thread their way down towards the run back to the finish, taking in the tests of Ruschkenhoek, Hoogheid and Ramschok along the way, as increasing speeds and changes of direction exert mounting pressure on the rear tyres. Also a unique test was the crown nature of the track, a legacy, the original public roads nature of the place. These crowns have gradually been eradicated over the years. In the 1990s, the authorities decided to close these roads permanently due to an increase in injuries and fatalities as folk attempted to create their own TT races, usually in the dark. The cathedral has been a place of Grand Prix worship since the third race of the World Championships in 1949, and with this experience comes the rich history. Still uniquely held on a Saturday, due to an ancient Calvinist sect originally banning sporting activities on Sundays. Don't think this applies now, but it still influences the day. A 100 miles per hour lap was cracked by Umberto Massetti on a Gilera in 1951, raised by Jeff Duke to 106 in 1954. The new configuration slowed things down, and it took until 1975 when Barry Sheen won his first 500cc race to approach these speeds, held in sweltering temperatures. Sweltering temperatures? Regular worshippers know the conditions here can change dramatically and at any time. As with most evolving tracks, Assen got safer and slower, with Casey Stoner's lap record from 2012 just pushing 108 miles per hour, always in front of big crowds, and Assen is also one of the places where World Superbikes also attracts a lot of folk, especially from the United Kingdom. Maybe a reason why the ever-growing British Superbikes has taken a round there. The circuit van Drenthe has witnessed many highs and lows over the years. Who can forget Kelly's last lap, last corner fall, whilst jousting with Foggy, leading to a dressing gown-clad Frankie slinging handbags around Carl's head in the paddock later. The same chicane also witnessed Randy Mamola and Raymond Roche pruning the flowers in 1984's GP, and Colin Edwards not getting this first win by clashing with Nicky Hayden in 2006 and countless others. Surely the best lap, last chicane, anywhere in the world. Remember Freddie Spencer's double year in 1985, which saw a big blip at a drenched Assen, when Christian Sauron's Galois Yamaha skittled Freddie on the first lap? Luckily for him, rival Eddie Lawson also got off by hitting a white line and disappearing into a dike. I'm told you can still get off by hitting white lines and disappearing into dikes up the road in Amsterdam to this day. Anyway, that year Mamola's misfiring NS500 limped over the line to win as me and my mate willed him to fall off to enable Rocket Ron Haslam to win his first Grand Prix. He didn't, though, and we gradually slipped further down the slippery bank to join a pile of drunken, mud-laden Germans. Ago from 68 to 72 and Duan from 94 to 98 presided over dynasties here. Dutch legends Middelburg and Hartog won here. Sometimes half the crowd seemed to turn up to urge triple world sidecar champion Egbert Stroyer on in his bitter struggles with Rolf Biland. Remember the only 250 win for Anthony West in 2003 and Jeremy McWilliams in the same class in 2001, as well as desperate times when Mick Doohan's career was saved by Dr. Costa sewing his legs together, enable one to nourish the other. Mick recovered, and the rest is history. That race in 92 saw Eddie Lawson give Kajiva their first pole, followed by their first win in Hungary the very next race. Mercifully, Assen has seen relatively few fatalities, the one of note being Works Yamaha rider Yasutomo Nagai, perishing when crashing on oil in 1995. He was the first Japanese rider to secure a World Superbike pole position outside Japan, as well as winning the 1994 Bol d'Or alongside Dominique and Christian Saron, and still finished the 1995 World Championship season, Superbike season that is, in fifth place overall. Careful evolution leaves the Circuit van Drenthe in great shape, now with a museum, leisure facilities and modern, varied spectator viewing choices. Donington take note. Assen has a strong North European flavour, and, as bikes have always been the priority here, the circuit still flows with positive camber and still suits the sport we love. There is no Tribune Herman Tilk here. Assen has a contract with Dorna until 2021, at least, so you've all got time to experience this Dutch temple, cathedral, of speed. In times past, the Continental Circus would pack up in Holland and head south for around 200 miles to the Ardennes Forest, scene of one of the last squabbles of the Second World War, the Battle of the Bulge. However, what also inhabits the landscape here was the quintessential Temple of Speed, a circuit that drew awe and fear in equal measure. Circuit Spa-Francorchamps has been described as a ragged triangle, linking the towns of Malmedy, Stavelot and Francorchamps, the town of Spa being nearby. This place, for bikes and cars alike, was seen as the absolute challenge of speed, poise and nerve, and for some, as a place where, put simply, the risk would eclipse that challenge. What sets this place apart from all others is how the closed half, which was still open roads you could use on your drive home from work until the turn of the millennium, have been developed into an iconic and beautiful facility, whilst beyond the other side of two locked gates lurks the original, wide open, white knuckle ride that still shimmers with history, fully intact. Regardless of how many family cars meander around it now, or how much street furniture obscures it, this is still very obviously the fast and furious landscape that defines so much. The Nürburgring, no more than a couple of hours away, has similar history, but it was a very different challenge. Randy Mamola called the ring a sinuous, tarmac-topped motocross track, but this Belgian superhighway might just echo shades of the Manx Mountain, especially parts of the run down to Signpost Corner. No, the only comparison this place had was the wide-open blasts of Reims in France. Both organising bodies knew it, and both wanted to claim that they were the fastest. Oh, and if the car fans amongst you think the Mulsanne straight from Le Mans 24 Hours could compare, then forget it. It was heard said that some drivers used the Mulsanne as a place to rest for a while. Spa's straights are not straight, and there was no rest. In case you're in any doubt, let me regale you with some lap records from down our moto history. 1953, Jeff Duke, Gilera, 111 miles per hour. 1960, John Surtees, MV, 120 miles per hour. 1974, Phil Reed, MV, 133 miles per hour. And the fastest, 1977, Barry Sheen, Suzuki, at just under 137 miles per hour in the same year as sidecars were at 124 miles per hour. 250s at 128 miles per hour, and even the 125s with Pier Paolo Bianchi's Morbidelli hitting a lap of 120 miles per hour. Bazza got around the just under 9 miles in 3 minutes, 50 seconds. Though everyone knows that in 1978, Johnny Cecotto went 1.7 seconds faster on his 500 Yamaha on his way to pole position, practice laps not counting for the record. By 1960, the cars were already beating this, and the outright fastest lap went to the Ferrari 312 of Jackie Ickx at 3 minutes, 12 seconds, almost 165 miles per hour. This in 1973. Spa-Francorchamps was conceived in 1920, though the first car race only attracted one entry. Nevertheless, popularity grew for all types of motorsport, and the roads were evolving, becoming wider and, of course, faster. In 1939, a new section, the Eau Rouge-Radillon's combination, was created, which cut out a slow hairpin. This is one of the defining images of Spa, the plunge down from La Source hairpin, past the old start and finish line, before a left-right flick and up the mountainous climb to the highest point of the track. This modification was first used in 1939 in tragic circumstances as British star Richard Seaman crashed before the famous La Source hairpin in torrential rain whilst way out in front, literally wrapping his Mercedes around a tree and setting the car alight. He died from his injuries the following day. Down the history of Spa, there has been a very high rate of attrition, with over 50 competitors and officials perishing. The circuit was tree-lined in many places and with solid banks, houses and dense woodland. If you left the course, you were very likely to hit something. Like the ring, the elevations and forest setting could mean contrasting weather conditions on different parts of the circuit, something that still happens today. Spa continued to be improved and modified, Reed made faster, with the final piece being the cutting out of the sharp bend into Stavelo and bypassing the town with a fearsome banked right-hander that fired you up the start of the climb back to the finish. This was in the heat of the fight with Reims to claim the title of Europe's fastest circuit, and by the time this punch was thrown, Spa had assumed the crown. The Motorcycle World Championships used the Ardennes venue from 1949 uninterrupted until 1978, though not every class ran every year. The premier bikes always did, though, with Giacomo Agostini leading in 500cc wins on 8 straight from 1966 to 1973. John Surtees scored 6, with his wins coming from a combination of 500 and 350 machines from 1956 to 1960. Freddie Spencer scored his debut win there in 1982 and the double in his double year of 1985. Legends Mamola, Gardner and Lawson all won one each, and Wayne Rainey brought the curtain down on the circuit in 1990, but it was Schwantz who claimed the lap record in 1989, though he went faster when claiming pole in 1990. By this time, the original 9-mile track was long gone, but he got around the, by modern standards, lengthy 4.3 miles in 2 minutes 23 seconds, an average of 108 miles per hour. Not much matches this, even today in MotoGP. World Superbikes sadly only made one visit in 1992, with the Kawasaki of Rob Phillis winning race 1 before the then-dominant Doug Polan won race 2 on the way to wrapping up title number 2 on the fast-by Ferrari Ducati. Still over six seconds a lap slower than the GP boys, though. The long circuit was abandoned after increasing safety concerns meant Formula 1 left after the 1970 race, which saw only a third of the field finish, whilst bikes soldiered on until 1978. In 1979 saw the organisers finally bow to pressure and chop the track off after the Kemmel Strait, taking out almost 5 miles, meeting the old road at the clubhouse corner where Richard Seaman had perished in 1939. There was, and still is, much praise for the retaining of the character and challenge of Spa. However, the new surface had barely been laid in 1979 when the bikes rolled into town for the then fourth round of the championship. Remember, this was the era when riders earned very little from Grand Prix, much more from negotiating appearance running money at internationals around Europe. The moneymakers were a dictatorial FIM, along with the circuit owners. This had begun to change, led by a vanguard including Sheen and Roberts, the American amazed at the lack of safety at some of the venues and the contempt with which the competitors were held. When the teams arrived at Spa, they were greeted by track work still continuing, much of the paddock being out of bounds, and a traditionally forceful and uncompromising Belgian organisation throwing threats around like confetti. More fears were confirmed when Sheen drove around the new section, plenty of runoff, but precious little grip. The sidecars and smaller classes managed okay, but the bigger bikes were really struggling. After practice, riders' representatives Sheen and Chicotto relayed their anger to the organisers, and even the softest tyres weren't looking worn. With over £7 million recently invested, the organisers and the Belgian government were in uncompromising mood, didn't call off the meeting early, and allowed tens of thousands of fans to travel. Back at the circuit, all the top riders signed a petition stating they would not race. The FIM threatened to withdraw their licences. The top riders began to pour out of the paddock and leave. The crowds arrived to a heavily depleted field, and the news that a much devalued meeting was to run, and there was a menacing atmosphere as scores of police were trying to control a very angry crowd. Some of the privateers felt they had to race to afford to get to the next one, and Kiwi Dennis Island won from Aussie Kenny Blake, with Brit Gary Slingham Lingham completing the podium ahead of a threadbare entry. This was seen as the start of the shift towards a big improvement in the safety and well-being of riders, though it led to me and you not being able to see the likes of Marc Márquez at Cadwell Park. Oh well, we can dream. So, what was it about the old circuit that garnered such respect and fear in equal measure? In July of this year, I rode over to see the Bikers Classic, an event which grows every year, featuring hundreds of early race bikes, ridden by many of yesterday's and today's stars. On a sweltering weekend, Wayne Gardner was guest of honour, ably backed up by Ago, Christian Saron, De Rodriguez, Hartog, and even Scott Redding on the Schwantz RGV. There's also a round of the FIM Endurance Series for pre-1982 machines that runs from 8 p.m. until midnight. A real treat watching the sun go down, Belgian beer in hand on a rare, rain-free weekend. I decided to rise early Sunday morning before the main day and have a good look at the legendary old place. It was already hot with bright sunshine as I rode up the perimeter road, catching glimpses of the mountain at Rodillion on my right as it flashed in and out of view through the tall, dense trees, whiffs of smoke from the early breakfasts mixed with low forest mist to create a timeless memory. The road kept climbing, wrapping itself around the outside of the track until I found the top gate at the highest point. Looking through that gate, you see the end of the Kemmel Strait and the double bend that starts the newer section. However, I was on the old worn tarmac, still scarred, that crested the hill before the motorised version of a downhill ski run started with the Haute de la Côte S's. Fairly simple and open, but you are already building speed through here. The houses that are today colourfully glinting in the morning sun, virtually unchanged from the days when they were only seen in monochrome. Then, on to Bernonville, still downhill, but over half a mile of a never-ending right-hander, where you are drifting as you continue to build speed. It was around this area that one of the blackest Grand Prix of Formula One history in 1960 saw Stirling Moss suffer broken legs and many other fractures and lay unconscious in the middle of the track, and Mike Taylor having a career-ending crash further down towards Stavelot. These two were in practice, but the race was much worse, as two promising British pilots died in horrific circumstances. The Cooper of Chris Bristow flipped several times, throwing him out and decapitating him on fencing, his body in the track almost causing further crashes. Later, Works driver Alan Stacey was struck in the face by a bird, his Lotus careering off a bank and into a field beyond, Stacey perishing in the flames that ensued, a grim trademark of the cars of the era. The right-hander eventually opens out and I stop on the left in a neglected-looking lay-by. This was once the chicane installed to slow things down, but in the race for speed it was abandoned, so you were going even quicker through Malmedy and then onto the Master Straight. Being a Sunday morning, it's eerily quiet as I cruise down here. I could be doing treble my speed, and I would be fine, as you go a mile and a half, now punctuated by a junction, to the infamous Master Kink. I pulled the VFR into another lay-by on my right, a further attempt at slowing things down, though I understand this one was never used. It's so quiet as I walk down to the kink, a left-right with a cafe, and two houses on the left, and a farmhouse on the right with a track slipping below road level. This is where Jackie Stewart ended up, covered in fuel and upside down with only fellow competitors, Graham Hill and Bob Bondurant, getting him out by borrowing tools from bystanders to release him in the torrential rain. It was here also that another particularly gruesome story comes from the 1973 24-hour sports car race, during which three drivers were killed. During a night pit stop, Hans Stuck told his co-driver Jochen Mass over the noise that he should look out for body parts at the Master Kink. Mass arrived there expecting to see bits of car on the road, but was appalled to discover it was in fact parts of an unfortunate Marshall. There was an Alfa Romeo timed at 200 miles per hour on the Master Straight in 1950. They didn't reduce speed much for the kink, as drivers and riders spoke not of the technical nature of these bends, rather of the absolute need to keep the throttle open for here and virtually all the course. This may sound easy enough, but at that point the real test began. At the absolute limits of speed and grip, you were required to judge the point of where the rudimentary rubber of the day started to break contact and slide. It was only the few that could face this challenge and maintain their velocity, the grim consequences for mistakes unspoken in the quiet and often somber paddocks. Out of the kink, you are still dropping down the ascent ever faster until you have fired up the artificial banked right that leads onto Hollowell and the climb back towards the finish. I stopped on this banking, now a one-way link going to the dead end of the second set of circuit gates. It's incredible how steep it is, built only for speed. Flags and banners used to characterise this corner. Now there are just some bits of Armco partially hidden behind bushes. You've been dropping for almost 4 miles, and now you're climbing up for over two more through La Carrière, Blanchimont, and back to the legendary La Source Hairpin, where in bygone days you'd see fans outside the bar watching the battle, beers in hand. That and numerous other famous buildings remain, beautifully maintained, but eerily empty. When these were public roads up to the millennium, surely someone lived here? I can think of nowhere else where the old coexists with the new so much, where the ultra-modern F1 suites and start line give way round the other side of La Source to the old grid and pit complex. This favourite circuit of so many people is still daunting by modern standards, but, compared to each side of those gates, a thankfully safer proposition. As with many circuits in Europe, there is a threat of Spa and other classic venues continuing to give way to Eccleston's relentless greed for billionaire Asian holiday destinations, and it needs to be said that Spa has developed such a wide array of events and experiences here that would it really be so sad if F1 packed its bags? The place would probably remain solvent as a result. Farewell then to Spa, in my humble opinion, the Temple of Speed. Unless, of course, you know better. The sixth and final Temples of Speed brings you various venues scattered around Europe that played a part in our Grand Prix history. Until next time.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for grabbing that interview with Mr. Tommy Aquino. Did you get to meet his mother, Carrie Aquino?
No, unfortunately not. He was out there just on his own, and I didn't even get a chance to speak to Jeff Cross, which I thought would have been a great interview. But he's coming back next year, so I'll make a point of picking on Jeff when he reappears in April. And Tommy, what a great guy. Looking forward to seeing what he can do, and a credit to his mum, certainly. Polite guy.
Then thank you, Steve, very much. Always great to have that. We're going to kind of poke you a little bit to get more Temples of Speed. I don't think we'll ever run out of them, although you may run out of your travel stuff. Ladies and gentlemen out in Motopod land, thank you for downloading and listening to yet another show. Pleasure to have Dave back on here again. Who knows who we'll have next week. I take all these slips of paper, throw them up in the air, and whoever lands first gets to do the show.
Best way to do it.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you would like to help us out at Motopod, which is greatly appreciated, you can once again do so by going to www.motopodcast.com. A little bit way down on the left-hand side of the page, you'll see a couple of yellow buttons. Donate and or subscribe. Either one works great. Feel free to join us. And once again, feel free to write into us, motopod@motopodcast.com. Love to hear what you have to say. Keep your cards and letters coming, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make. Dave, I know that it's getting late there for you, and the afternoon of my day is coming through. So from this side of the pond over here in California, I bid you adieu over there in the Lincolnshire.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jim. Absolute pleasure as always. And I look forward to speaking to you next week.
Perfect. We will talk then. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye. just need to move my location.
Yep.
Down the stairs. Don't trip up over anything, because I'm going to sound alright. What if I do?
I know what's going in the outtake this week.